I stayed home and got ready to paint my bedroom a horrendous shade of pink just because, and watch Real Housewives with my friend. My face heats. I'm so sorry, Ash. Why didn't you call me? She scoffs. What, more than those 9 times? Call me old-fashioned, but once I hit the double digits, I start to feel a tad desperate. Oh my God, I groan. The beach, we didn't have service. We, she says. My throat tightens. I really can't believe I missed it. It's fine, she says. It's obviously not, I say. It's unbelievably shitty. Seriously, Daphne, don't worry about it, she says. I knew you were a wee girl, and now you've got a wee. As the internet likes to say, when someone tells you who they are, believe them. Ashley, I cry. What are you talking about? Miles, she says. That's who you blew me off for, right? My heart feels like there's a perforated line forming down its middle, a force tugging at each side. I'm not a wee with Miles. We're not that. Maybe not, she says. But clearly something changed while I was in Sedona, and whatever it is that the two of you are doing now, you don't need me anymore. Her words knock me back. Is that what I did? Is that who I am? A person who treats people like loosely penciled in backup plans in case nothing better comes along? I feel sick. Worse, I'm about to cry. I try to rein it in, but my voice crackles. You're right. I treated you like a fallback, and that's shitty. I'm sorry. That's not what you are to me. She drops her eyes to the concrete. Look, I'm trying to be on time to work, so if you don't mind, I'm going to just... Yeah, I scratch out. Of course. She walks away without looking back. My heart breaks a little, and I have no one to blame but myself. After work, I stagger my departure so that Ashley, who barely said 4 words to me all day, isn't walking out at the same time as me. Miles isn't here yet, so I pace along the curb, trying to burn off the cortisol flooding my system. After a while, I go sit on the sun-hot bench and try to read. For once, I can't seem to escape into a book. My mind keeps going back to Ashley. A part of me just wants the comfort of being wrapped up in Miles's arms, everything else temporarily obliterated. But then again, that's how I got here. I let myself get absorbed again. Still, I'll feel better when he gets here. I'll figure out a way to make it up to Ashley, to prove I'm not that person. I won't let myself be. I check the time. 20 minutes late and no word yet. With how often Miles forgets his phone or lets it die, that's not a huge surprise. I pull my laptop out and angle it against the sun. I'm still connected to the library's Wi-Fi, so I pull up my readathon checklist and keep working. The parking lot empties. The streetlights pop on as the sun begins its slow plod towards sunset. 40 minutes have passed, and a pit opens in my stomach. I snap my computer shut and call Miles, trying not to picture him unconscious in a ditch on the side of the road or in any other of a million worst-case scenarios. The call rings out to voicemail. I type, "Everything okay?" and hit send, then start pacing again. "You're being ridiculous," I tell myself. "He's fine." I check my phone. Again. 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 9 times. Finally, on the 10th, my phone vibrates. I nearly throw it in my hurry to get it eye level. "Shit, day got away from me. Sorry, but yeah, all good here, you." I take it to mean, "All good here, you?" Which begs the question, where is here? At first, I'm just so relieved he's alive and well, or else kidnapped by someone who texts exactly like him, that I literally sit down in the middle of my pacing, right on the library's lawn, and say aloud, "Thank God." But then, slowly, a new feeling simmers through me. This is Miles, I remind myself. He'll have an explanation. I'm backsliding toward the pit I found myself in 100 times before, waiting on someone I know in my gut isn't coming. But in the length of our friendship, Miles has never stood me up. The things he said the other night about the men in my life not wanting to be seen, running as soon as they are, play back like a siren, a warning I missed. It doesn't make sense. I'm missing something. I hammer out another text. I thought you were picking me up. Miles types for a second, then stops without sending a message. My body goes hot, my skin too tight. Suddenly, I need to move. I need to get away. I can't stay here another second. I grab my stuff and walk, leave the parking lot. The sun has started setting, but I'll make it back before dark. Except the idea of going home nauseates me. In a temporary fit of deluded ambition, I pull my phone out to Google CrossFit gyms. Maybe I could burn off this anxiety by throwing tires or whatever. Miles is calling. I try to answer, but I've just missed the last ring. A car honks, and I realize I've stopped in an intersection. I wave an apology and run across, dialing him back. Straight to voicemail. He must be leaving me a message. As I power walk, I eye the screen every few seconds, waiting for the message to buzz in. Instead, I get a text alert. Yeah, sorry, something came up, I'm really sorry. Three sorries deep and no closer to an explanation. At this point, I feel stupid and a little angry. I take a deep breath. Things come up. We don't owe each other anything, I tell myself. We made no promises. But the truth is, Miles made me feel so safe, and now I feel completely discarded. This is what you get, a voice taunts in my mind. When you make all the same mistakes again and again, when you choose the wrong people to trust and let down the right ones, when you let someone in who's told you in every conceivable way not to rely on them. Trust people's actions, not their words. Don't love anyone who isn't ready to love you back. Let go of the people who don't hold on to you. Don't wait on people who don't hurry for you. Instantly, I feel so tired. Exhausted. As badly as I don't want to go home, there's nowhere else for me to go. I've just started back toward the apartment when my phone rings again. My heart soars in anticipation. He'll have an explanation, something that makes sense of all of this. Except it's not him calling. It's an unknown number. I answer, just in case, trying to sound cool, calm, collected, and overall diametrically opposite how I actually feel. Hello? Hi, a chipper, feminine voice says. Is this Daphne Vincent? I sniff, modulate my voice. Who's this? My name's Anika. I'm calling from the Ocean City Public Library. It takes 3 full seconds for me to make sense of what she's saying. We were really impressed by your resume, she goes on, and we'd love to set up a virtual interview. I press the heel of my hand to my forehead. The world keeps spinning. This is what I've been waiting for, hoping for. Hello? She says. Sorry, I stammer. Yes, I'm here. Would you be available for an interview sometime in the next 2 weeks? She says. Assuming you're still interested. It feels like I'm swallowing a rock. Of course I am, I force out. I'm not even sure which part I'm agreeing with, whether I'm available, whether I'm interested. But it's the only answer that could possibly make sense, right? The escape hatch I've been waiting for right when the whole house of cards is falling down, and I should feel happy, or at least relieved, but all I can feel is this whole chest ache. Yet another loss of someone, something I didn't even have to begin with. Fantastic, she says. Could you just send us your availability and we'll set something up? I clear my throat. I'll check my calendar as soon as I get home. Home. I ignore the ping in my heart at that word. It's just an apartment. It's never been mine. 31. Tuesday, August 6th. 11 days. Miles doesn't come home that night. I know because I don't sleep. I'm not waiting for him, though. I'm thinking about Ashley, mentally drafting and revising apologies, wondering how I managed to do to her the exact thing I hate most. I always identified with my mom, but in this situation, I know who I've acted like, and it's not Holly Vincent. I want to hide at home, skip work Tuesday, but there's too much going on, and I can't leave Ashley or Harvey in the lurch. So I arrive a full 20 minutes before my shift starts, having ordered full-blown espresso from Fika, which has me moving at warp speed.
"You buy me a three-piece suit?"
Harvey asks as he moseys through the fog to meet me at the locked front doors. He tips his head toward the oversized paper box in my arms.
"Pastéis de nata," I explain. "Portuguese custard tarts, for Ashley's birthday."
The idea came to me around 2 a.m., By 4, I'd found a bakery that had them, 40 minutes south of here. At 5, I was on my way. Harvey stares at me, concerned.
"You do know Ashley's Persian, not Portuguese, right?"
"What? I know," I say. "She just told me she fantasized about moving to Portugal, so..."
He rears back.
"What's in Portugal?"
"Pastéis de nata," I say. "And beautiful beaches, I think."
He shrugs to himself and unlocks the doors.
"Well, I'm glad you remembered, because I forgot her donuts at home yesterday, and the grandkids ate them."
Inside, I set the box on her side of the desk, then busy myself updating displays so I can miss her arrival. All day, we manage to dodge each other, the box of pastries gradually emptying as she, Harvey, and a couple of her favorite regulars pick over them. When I come back from lunch, she's sitting at her computer and flicks a glance my way. "Hi," I say tentatively. "Hello," she replies. I take my seat and try to focus, despite the noxious cloud of awkwardness. Eventually, I settle into a rhythm, and then Landon arrives to relieve Ashley for the evening shift.
"Sweet goodies," he says,
one earbud already in, the other blasting from around his neck as he slips behind the desk.
"Daphne brought them," Ashley says, gathering her things. "For my birthday." "A couple people went in on them," I automatically say.
"Still can't lie for shit," she says, without averting her gaze from her computer.
"Can I have one?"
Landon asks her. "Of course," she says. "I'm leaving them for the night crowd to finish off. Otherwise, Mulder will eat all of them and turn into the mask by bedtime." Landon leans over to pluck a pastéis de nata from the center.
"The mask?
Young people."
Ashley grabs her green pleather bag and eyes me.
"Thanks for whatever those things are."
"Pastéis de nata," I tell her. "Portugal's famous breakfast treat."
I can't tell if she's caught off guard in a good way or just confused. Maybe she doesn't even remember our conversation about Portugal.
"And it's my pleasure," I add.
She nods, an acknowledgement with no visible emotion attached to it, then jogs her bag higher and leaves. An empty apartment greets me. Again. All my life, this moment, this feeling has been a constant. Doing homework at a kitchen table while Mom was at night class, planning programs on the rug while Peter took a client out for drinks, sitting on the bleachers at school while every other kid's parent showed up to take them home, Dad already halfway to a sound bath that a Trader Joe's cashier invited him to. Maybe it's time to just make peace with it. Maybe certain people are destined to be solitary creatures. Maybe no matter how hard I try, I'll end up back here. I drop my bag, kick off my shoes, and shuffle into the dining room. The apartment has been thoroughly cleaned since this morning. The breakfast table is cleared of junk mail and water glasses and bags from the pharmacy. Now there's just a small white box wrapped in gold twine, and beside it, a scrap of paper. In extraordinarily messy handwriting, "Sorry I missed you." A wave of déjà vu rocks me. It was easy to toss Dad's note in the trash. I knew exactly what to expect. With this, I can't help hoping for something more. I slide the twine off, pop the box open, and start to laugh.
Fudge. A box of fudge. So underwhelming as to border on absurd. "Sorry I missed you," Here's some chocolate and condensed milk. But the funniest part is, I did the exact same thing to Ashley. The hysteric laughter is about to tumble into outright crying when, miracle of all ill-timed miracles, my phone rings with a call from Dad. Is this a joke? I demand of the universe and or empty apartment. I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to talk to anyone. I'd even rejected a call from Mom on the walk home because I hadn't decided yet whether to tell her about the Maryland job or not. I told myself I didn't want to get her hopes up, but the truth is, I don't want to get mine any higher than they already are. I just need to get through the interview and the readathon and see how everything shakes out. I send Dad's call to voicemail and pull up my readathon checklist, desperate for a distraction, and scan the list of supplies we still need. Then I start dragging the remaining wedding stuff out of the closet, sorting out what I can repurpose for the fundraiser, napkins, plates, flameless tea lights, and what I should just donate. The rest, the dress and everything else sellable, is still at Ashley's. One more problem I can't think about right now. I take a quick break to order dinner, then dive back into sorting and packing until I hear a pounding at the door, the dinner I have no appetite for.
You can leave it there,
I shout, jumping up and sprinting down the hallway. I look around for a sweater I can pull on over my sports bra.
I already paid and tipped when I ordered.
No answer. Then, the scrape of a throat being cleared.
It's Peter.
I honestly almost blurt out, Peter who? While pulling my cardigan off the coat hook and onto my body. Then it clicks, like a bullet into a barrel. Peter. I open the door, half expecting to have my only workable theory disproven. There's no way Peter Collins is here, on my doorstep. Except he is.
Hi, Daphne,
he says with a woeful smile.
Can I come in? Just for a minute,
he promises, his green eyes glossy and brow furrowed in that contrite yet hurt way that used to make my kneecaps melt. Not that he had much occasion to use it. Peter had always been reliable. I always knew where he was, when to expect him. Between our synced calendars, our phone's location sharing, our rigid schedule, our unspoken agreement to send the leaving the bar now, see you soon, and ran to the store for more milk while you were in the shower text messages, there wasn't much space for fights. I never had to ask, when are you coming home? I never had to worry he wouldn't. Until, of course, he didn't. I'm too shocked to argue. I widen the door, and he steps inside, looking around with abject wonder, like I'm leading him into an accursed ancient pyramid and not a small, eclectically decorated apartment inside a renovated meatpacking facility.
It looks different, he says, from the last time I was here.
I shoot him a look over my shoulder. Bold move, mentioning the last time he was here, to see his then-best friend, now fiancé. I make a non-committal sound and lead him to the living room. The whole time, I'm kind of wishing I'd just started laughing in his face, refused to say a single word, and just kept laughing until he slunk away. I gesture toward the less comfortable of our two chairs, and he sits, waits for me to do the same. I don't. His eyes wander over the trail of wedding detritus.
You still have so much stuff.
Taking another load to the thrift store tomorrow. I lie. He winces. I stare. After several awkward seconds, he says,
You look great, Daph.
I do not. I'm pretty busy, Peter. The corners of his mouth twist. I see a question forming on his lips, but he shakes his head, apparently deciding to let it go. Another few awkward seconds pass. His gaze meets mine, holds, smolders. I turn to refold a couple of tablecloths. I'm going to keep packing while you talk.
I'm sorry, Daphne,
he says. Yeah, you told me that, I say.
No, I mean, I'm sorry.
The chair scrapes back. I turn to find him marching toward me. I still have an ivory table runner gripped in my hands when he grabs them and holds them between us. I'm so sorry, he says. I was stupid and short-sighted. It was all just about chasing a rush, and honestly, I think I was afraid of the commitment, of marriage.
I half laugh. So you got engaged to someone else?
He shakes his head. We're not together. We called it off. For a moment, I'm speechless. It feels a little like a low-grade earthquake just rumbled through the room.
She called it off, I say.
He huffs. It was mutual. We both realized how stupid we'd been. I think I knew within a week, honestly, but I'd already made such a wreck of things, I figured I needed to see it through.
Blood rushes through my ears, dimming his voice. I feel dizzy. Plenty of physical sensations, but hardly any emotional ones. So you knew it was a mistake, I say, gathering my wits. And you were going to, what, just marry her anyway? You ripped up my life, and then you were going to destroy hers, too? For fucking pride?
His jaw drops, hurt flooding his features. I've never talked to him like this. It's close to things I've screamed in my darkest late-night fantasy speeches, but it doesn't actually feel good to say. It doesn't feel good to hurt him. Because truthfully, I don't feel hurt by him right now. Wronged? Sure. Hurt? No. He's not capable of that anymore. I step back. I'm sorry. I don't want to be mean to you. He shakes his head.
I deserve it.
You do, I say, but still, I don't want to treat you like that. It's hard to take any of this seriously. It's hard to trust what you say now after all the lying.
Lying?
His brow scrunches.
I told you as soon as anything happened with Petra. I know I acted like scum, but I never lied.
You told me there was nothing between you, I say. For years. You insisted she was totally wrong for you.
She was, he cuts in. That's my point.
And that you could never be with her, I go on.
Daphne, that's what I'm saying, he counters. I couldn't. I can't.
And that you'd never seen her like that, I finish.
I hadn't, he insists. Not really. When I said all of that to you, I meant it, every word. And now I know it's true. It's just, we were barreling toward our wedding, Daph, and I freaked out. And Petra freaked out too because she knew the relationship between her and me was probably going to change. We got confused. And I know it makes no sense because I was ready to marry you, so the time for that kind of confusion should have been way past. You have no idea how sorry I am. I'll spend my whole life making it up to you, trying to get back to how perfect we were together.
Peter, stop, I say. We weren't perfect, obviously, or this couldn't have happened.
Fine, he says. Maybe we weren't, but you were. You were perfect for me, and I threw it away. I miss your cute little giggle, and I miss going to visit Cooper and Sadie with you and getting brunch at Hearth and going to the gym together and having dinner with my family. God, my family, Daphne. They miss you too. I was so deluded. I thought they'd be on board with the whole Petra thing, and her parents were thrilled, but mine? They know me better than all this. They knew it was a mistake right away. You're part of my family, Daphne. You belong with me.
As he's saying it, I feel the telltale prickle behind my nose, the heat coursing into my cheeks. Tears are surfacing, and I can't stop them. Taking this as encouragement, he moves closer.
We can get our life back, he whispers. It's not too late.
I can't help but laugh a little as I dab my eyes with the table runner. It is too late. The life he's describing, it isn't one I want. It's right in a general sense, and all wrong in the particulars. A steady partner, a family, good friends to take trips and share boozy brunches and throw Halloween parties with, a home. But I don't want Peter's too big house whose mortgage doesn't have my name on it. And I don't want Peter's friends who don't care about me. And as much as I dreamed of being a part of Peter's tight-knit family, I realize now I'd also never cried in front of them, never complained about work or opened up about how hard I found it to trust new people. I'd never even used a curse word in front of them. Their perfection hadn't drawn me in, it had intimidated me. I spent our whole relationship auditioning, the same way I always feel when I'm with Dad, praying I'm doing enough to make the cut. And I'm not sure why I wasted all that time and energy, because when I think about family, that thing I'd always longed for, it's never been a Norman Rockwell painting that I picture. It's me and Mom on the couch eating microwaved corn dogs while Dial M for Murder plays on TV. It's running out from the library at night to her car, a greasy box of Little Caesar's pizza in the passenger seat, her joking, "I thought we'd do Italian." It's being pulled away from watching the frost melt on the living room window to make stovetop hot cocoa from a packet, and that last tight hug at the end of the airport security line, and packing up cardboard boxes, knowing I'll always have what I need, no matter how much I leave behind. My life 5 months ago was picture perfect, but it wasn't the picture I wanted. And I don't want him. I'm totally over him. If any part of me had wondered whether this thing with Miles was just a distraction, a rebound, or an act of vengeance, that part is brutally dispelled. Because even now, in my misery, no part of me jumps at the chance to go back to how things were before. "I'm sorry, Peter," I say. "I don't want that." His voice wobbles.
"You can't mean that, Daph."
"I do," I whisper. The corners of his mouth twitch downward. I wonder if he's thinking the same thing I am, that these are ironic last words for our relationship. It takes him several seconds, several nods and throat clears, to regain control. Then he starts toward the door. My hosting gene kicks in, and I follow, walk him out of my home and life. He opens the door and steps into the hallway, but he doesn't leave. Instead, he stands there, maybe considering a Hail Mary or maybe a fuck you. Finally, he faces me.
"If you need some place to stay, you can come home while you're looking. I'll take the couch."
He reads the blank expression on my face, and I see a flicker of something like smugness in his not-quite smile.
"They'll get back together," he says. "You know that, right?"
I stare at him, determined not to say anything, even as a sinkhole opens in my low belly, everything collapsing as it falls through.
"He already spent all day helping her move her shit out," he says.
"What?" I don't mean to give him the satisfaction, it just slips out, and he pounces on it, almost smiling.
"Yesterday," he says, "like 5 minutes after we ended things, he's there moving her out. You honestly think they're done with each other, Daphne?"
I tuck my elbows against my sides to keep from shaking, to hide that my insides feel like a hurricane, not the calm eye of a storm, but the vicious edges tearing everything to shreds. He's wrong. He has to be. Even if he's not, it doesn't matter. That's not why I'm not getting back with Peter, though I now understand that's what he thinks. That I'd never turn him down unless there was someone else, that I'd always rather be with someone than by myself, even if that person is completely wrong for me. Even in this bleak moment, I feel a spike of something cool and bright. Hope, or relief, or a tiny tendril of joy, the thinnest silver lining of a jet black cloud. Because he's wrong. I don't want to be a part of the wrong we. I'd rather be on my own, even if it hurts right now. Someday I'll be okay. Someday. Goodbye, Peter. I shut the door. 32. Wednesday, August 7th, 10 days. I should have checked the weather before I left for work on Wednesday, but when I heard Miles moving around his room, I ran for the front door. I didn't have the time or energy for a serious conversation. So I left, without car keys, or a jacket, or an umbrella. At the library, things were a bit less frosty between me and Ashley. Her curt politeness feels even worse. We fully reverted to co-workers. And now I'm walking home in pouring rain, even though she offered me a ride because I didn't want her to feel obligated. I stop at an intersection, and a soft-top Jeep flashes its lights, signaling that I can cross. I dart to the far side of the street, managing to stomp through three oily puddles in the process. As I'm passing the car, it honks, and I jump, readying myself for a debaucherous catcall. The window slides down, and the driver leans across the passenger seat. A messy head of dark hair, an upturned nose, a scruffy face that makes my heart feel like it's been double-bounced on a trampoline.
"Thought you might need a ride," Miles says.
All I can think to say is, "Did you get a new car?"
"Long story," he murmurs. "Tell you on the way?"
I don't want to be furious and devastated. I want to be indifferent and dignified. It's hard to be either with sewer rat hair and mascara streaks to your jaw.
"You can just take me to Cherry Hill and I'll get a cab," I say awkwardly, climbing in. "No need for you to be late to work."
My teeth instantly start chattering from the AC. Miles turns the heat knob all the way up, the windshield fogging at the edges where the wipers can't reach.
"They won't be slammed yet," he says. "It's fine."
"It's not worth getting in trouble," I say.
At a red light, he looks over at me.
"I was trying to meet you at the library, but there was an accident on Tremaine."
I focus on the world of blue, green, gray outside the windows, keeping him safely in my periphery.
"Thanks anyway."
"Daphne."
"Hmm?"
He pulls to the curb.
"Can we talk for a minute?"
Our eyes tentatively meet. I look away, stomach dropping when I spot the taffy green cottage two houses down like a cruel joke. You thought you could be different, want something different, but you're you.
"Daphne," he says quietly, "can you look at me? I want to apologize to you."
"For what?" My gaze judders back.
"You know what," he says.
"I don't," I say. "All I know is I waited an hour for someone who didn't show up. The rest, why you totally disappeared for 24 hours, that's just a guess."
A guess loosely drawn by Peter in the most painful way conceivable.
"So if you want to apologize for something," I say, trying to lean into the anger, away from the ache, "you're going to have to explain what it is exactly that you did."
"I panicked," he says.
There it is. I'm still the woman with too many expectations, and Miles is the guy who panics when they're set on him.
"I didn't tattoo my name on you while you were sleeping," I say.
"I know that," he replies.
"So what?" I ask. "You changed your mind, and instead of just texting me, you left the state?"
"I didn't leave the state," he says. "I woke up and something came up. A friend needed help, and I lost track of time."
Something came up. A friend. Something better. Someone better. He's not admitting who it was.
"And it shouldn't matter. The same way whatever Dad wrote in that note doesn't make a difference. Miles telling me he ditched me for Petra won't change anything. But I want him to say it. I want to push as hard as possible against all the bruises in my heart until it changes me. Until I learn to stop fucking everything up."
"Who?" I ask. He scrubs a hand up his forehead, through his hair, shakes his head. "He'd be doing me a favor, putting me out of my misery, dropping a period at the end of this sentence."
"Please,"
I plead. He breathes out,
"Petra."
Some part of me, I realize, was holding on to the possibility that Peter was misinformed or outright lying. I didn't know it was there, that ember of hope, and I hate myself for it. My throat closes off, my chest tightening. I nod, and nod, and nod, trying to think of even one thing to say.
"She just needed to borrow my truck to move some stuff,"
Miles says, voice fraying.
"And like I said, I got caught up."
Caught up. There will always be a Petra. Someone more interesting, someone more fun, someone who needs less or offers more.
And then I snapped out of it, he says. And I realized how badly I'd fucked up, and I left. Traded cars with her so she could use the truck and booked it, and I had this big plan for how to make it up to you, a surprise, but I couldn't make it happen. I tried and I couldn't, so I came home with this stupid fucking box of fudge, and I know it's pathetic and it's not enough.
Miles, I close my eyes, rubbing my heels against the sockets as I organize my thoughts. I don't need a better apology present. My hands fall to my lap. This is my fault. He balks.
What? No, it's definitely not.
You did exactly what I should have expected, I say. He jerks back as if I slapped him.
What the fuck is that supposed to mean?
I'm not trying to be hurtful, I say quickly. I'm saying you're off the hook.
Off what hook, Daphne? He demands.
You told me you don't do expectations or obligations, I say.
I said they make me panic, Miles replies,
sounding vaguely panicked now, too. I turn in my seat, the windshield wipers still squeaking against the glass, rain pattering the roof.
And you did panic, even though you didn't want to, and I did expect something, even though I tried not to.
Good, he half shouts. Expect something! You want to put me on a hook? Put me on the hook! I freaked out, Daphne, but that doesn't mean I don't love you.
My stomach lurches, heart clenching like a fist. My skin goes from fiery hot to clammy and cold, and that word lodges itself between my ribs like a poison-tipped arrow. I need it out. Know the wound will gush when it's gone, but don't care.
No,
I stammer.
No?
Miles gives a hoarse laugh.
How is that a response to what I just said? I just told you I love you, Daphne. And I'm telling you no.
I undo my seatbelt with trembling hands.
You don't get to say that to me. You don't get to disappear and then show up and buy me fucking fudge and pick me up from work and tell me you love me.
I do love you, he cries.
My breath comes fast.
You can't just throw that out there like it makes everything better. I didn't need an I love you or a box of fudge or whatever big plan you had to make it up to me. I don't even like surprises. None of that stuff matters when you don't show up for the little things, and if you loved me, you'd know that.
I fumble with the lock on the car door, shove it open.
What are you doing?
Miles asks, his voice wrenching upward.
I'm getting out, I stammer.
Why?
He says. It's mostly stopped raining now. Even if it hadn't, the storm wouldn't have stopped me.
You know the worst part?
I force out as I turn back to him on watery legs.
I wasn't even worried when I walked out of work and you weren't there. I didn't worry for the first hour, and when I did, it was for you. That's how much I trusted you.
How safe I'd felt. His lips part, the hard lines of his face going lax.
And what?
He says, his voice so thin it's nearly a whisper.
All of that's just gone now?
The softness in his eyes and voice make me feel like something inside my rib cage is tearing. I don't want to hurt him.
I just don't want him to hurt me either.
I can't let myself be absorbed into this.
There's a job, I blurt. Close to my mom. I'm interviewing next week.
His mouth falls open again, his eyes oily dark. He presses his lips together again, swallows.
So that's it. You're leaving.
That was always the plan.
The words quiver out of me. I steel myself to go on.
We knew this wouldn't work, no matter how much fun we have together.
His features flash first with hurt, then acceptance. After a second, he says,
got it.
The clouds overhead are breaking up, and the tears are working their way down my face.
Storm's over,
I whisper.
I'll walk from here.
He looks back to the steering wheel and quickly wipes at the corner of his eye, which makes my heart feel like it's shattering. I shut the door and turn away, listening to his engine receding, unable to watch him disappear. After a minute, I start to walk. The fairy tale cottage's drapes are open, its windows aglow. Inside, three people amble past, a blazer-wearing woman slightly ahead of a young couple, arm in arm, laughing at something she said. A realtor selling a couple on the life they could have there. The late-nights binge watching the X-Files on the couch they picked out together. The early mornings making toast while they're still too tired to speak. The kids who will earn their first scars in the backyard and badly practice instruments at inconvenient times. And the way their favorite candle's scent will gradually infuse the walls so that every time they come back from a trip, exhausted, and dump their bags inside the door, they'll smell that they're where they belong. All those moments throughout the days, weeks, months that don't get marked on calendars with hand-drawn stars or little stickers. Those are the moments that make a life. Not grand gestures, but mundane details that over time accumulate until you have a home instead of a house. The things that matter. The things I can't stop longing for. There's only one place that feeling exists for me. Only one person with whom I belong. Honey, Mom answers right away. What's up? You're busy, I say. No, hold on a second. The voices fade, then cut out as she closes a door. What's up? Mom, you're clearly in the middle of something, I say. I'm never too busy for you, she says. Tell me what's going on. Where to start? Dad came to visit. Oh, shit, she says. That's what he wanted your address for? I thought he was just mailing you something. Same, I say. But no, he was stopping by. I leave out the with his new wife part. He's out of her life, and she prefers it that way. I'm sorry, she says. I should have asked you, but he just wanted to confirm the address if I'd had any idea. No, Mom, it's fine, I say. I would have told you to give it to him. She hesitates. So how was it? Great, I admit. And then terrible. So the usual, she says. Basically. He's always been great, for a while. She sighs. I'm sorry, sweetheart. I know it sucks. It does. Tears well in my eyes. It sucks so much. After a pause, she says, You deserve a better dad. I wish I could give that to you. You did! I wipe my eyes dry, but my voice is tearier than ever. You've always been my mom and my dad and my best friend. You've always been absolutely everything for me. Oh, baby, she says softly. I love you more than everything else on this planet combined. But no one person can be everything we need. Sometimes I couldn't even really do a good job at being your mother, let alone those other things. You were perfect, I say. You were amazing. Amazing, maybe, she says, but far from perfect. Do you know how many school recitals I fell asleep during? I sniff. No. However many you had, she replies. I chortle. That's like drifting off to the tune of 45 Street Cats in Heat. I wouldn't know, she says. In my dreams, the fifth grade class sang beautifully. I sink onto my rug, face in my hands, quivering with laughter. If I could do it again, she says after a second, I wouldn't have moved you around so much either. You did what you had to, I say. I thought so at the time, she says. But the truth is, I think we both could have been happier with less. We were in that first apartment, just the two of us, remember? I do. Warmth brims in my chest. That place had thin walls and leaky pipes, but Mom made it feel like an adventure we were setting out on. We were the kids camping out in the Met in from the mixed-up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. Or the titular children from the boxcar children living in the titular boxcar. I was just so scared I couldn't really do it on my own, she goes on. And so many decisions I made were based on the fear of what could go wrong instead of my hopes for what might go right. Every time that fear got tripped, I picked you up and moved you away rather than facing the possibility of discomfort. I never took any chances. You were a realist, I tell her. Honey, she laughs. I'm a cynic, and a cynic is a romantic who's too scared to hope. It feels like a nail driven into my sternum. Is that what I am? I ask her. You, she says. You, my girl, are whoever you decide to be. But I hope you always keep some piece of that girl who sat by the window hoping for the best. Life's short enough without us talking ourselves out of hope and trying to dodge every bad feeling. Sometimes you have to push through the discomfort instead of running. I know right then what I need to do. As badly as I want to run, this is my mess, and first I have to face it. Thanks, Mom, I say. What did I do exactly? She asks. You're here, I say. Whenever it counts, you're here. When I grow up, I want to be you. She laughs. Oh, God, no. Just be you. The best you. The most you. When I get off the phone with her, I text Harvey right away. Think you can talk Ashley into an impromptu poker night next time Mulder's with Duke? 33. Friday, August 9th. 8 days. Ashley beats me into work on Friday. She doesn't look up as I round the desk to take my spot, or when I pick up the paper Fika-stamped cup already by my mouse. On its side, someone has written Ashley's name, though somehow spelled much more incorrectly than if the barista had simply gone with A-S-H-L-E-Y. Out of the corner of her eye, she catches me sniffing it, and her pink-painted lips curl. It's not poisoned, if that's what you're wondering. I was more worried about urine. I joke. Well, after you taste it, let me know if you think there's too much cardamom in my diet. I take another sniff and a sip. Spicy, sweet, perfection. Thank you. I chance a look her way, but her eyes are glued to her monitor, nails clacking against her keyboard. A few of us went in on it, she deadpans. Give them my regards, I say. She's not ready for more chit-chat than that, it seems, so we fall into quietly working at our separate stations. Still, it's a start. From back in the office, Harvey gives me a knowing wink and a thumbs up, confirming tomorrow night's plan is in motion. On Saturday, I wait 2 hours after our shift ends before punching Ashley's address into my GPS. It leads me north up the peninsula, then toward the shore, the final right turn rapidly approaching. I duck my head to peer out the passenger window and slam on my brakes as a break in the foliage reveals a low, squat house tucked back from the road. The car behind me honks, and I put on my blinker as I ease onto the flagstone driveway. It curves back and down to a sleek, mid-century pseudo-mansion. Behind it, the bay glitters, the view uninterrupted apart from a few pine trees. I'd assumed Ashley never wanted to hang out at her place because she preferred to keep her social life separate from her life as a mom. Now I wonder if she was just playing coy about being absolutely loaded. I park in front of the bright orange double doors, each slotted with a stack of narrow rectangular windows, and motion sensor lights flick on. Despite the little sign picketed into the planter, Harvey has assured me that Ashley doesn't actually have a security system. In fact, he's pretty sure she found the sign in someone's trash after Duke moved out. The spare key is exactly where he said it would be, under an empty pot around the side of the house. Two nights ago, when we hatched this plan, Harvey and I were both so sure this would only delight Ashley. Now, I'm less certain. I am, essentially, breaking and entering. I step over the threshold, prepared to bolt if the alarm sounds. It doesn't. I take off my shoes and wander deeper, the terrazzo entryway giving way to a hallway on the right, followed by a massive chef's kitchen with flush walnut cabinets and a Sputnik chandelier spanning the island. On the left, there's a sunken 70s-style living room with a semicircular couch wound around a fireplace. I follow the hallway to the first bedroom, a guest room, I'd guess, based on the bland pseudo-coastal decor. The next room is covered with RPG franchise posters and drawings of anime characters. At the end of the hall, I reach a bedroom nearly the size of our apartment, complete with a walk-in closet that feeds into the ensuite bathroom of my dreams. If that weren't a clear enough indicator that this is Ashley's room, there's also the tarp, paint buckets, and paint rollers sitting in one corner, unused. There isn't much else in the room. A bed, a dresser, a side table. I wonder whether Duke took most of the furniture with him. There's a sadness to this space that I didn't expect. It feels like a place that used to be home. I hope it can be again. Ashley deserves that. I set my stuff down, grab the unopened roll of painter's tape, and get to work. It's therapeutic painting along the baseboards and ceiling, and the Miles-inspired Sad Girl playlist blaring from my phone gives the experience a cathartic edge, too. It takes an hour just to tape everything off. Then I do the first coat of the upper cut-in and step down from the step stool I found in the garage to admire my handiwork before starting the lower cut-in. I'm nearly finished with the first coat when a throat clears behind me. I whirl around, brandishing my paintbrush like it's a sword. Ashley stands with her arms crossed, one jet black brow sharply raised. "You're back," I say. "And you're listening to Adele's Greatest and Saddest," she replies. I grab my phone from the step stool's cup holder and hit pause. On screen, I see the beginning of a text from Harvey. "Sorry, I did my best, but..." "Is poker night over already?" I ask. The randomly scheduled poker night that suddenly had to be this Saturday because every other night this month was booked for everyone? Ashley says. "That poker night?" I grimace. "I only went to see what the hell was going on," she says. "Next time you want to keep a secret from me, you should know how terrible Harvey is at lying. And you were weird at work." She's right. I should have seen this coming. After a fraught silence, she says, "You look like shit." "Thank you," I say. She smiles. Pesky hope climbs my ribcage. "If you hate it," I say quickly, "I'll paint it all back. And I don't have to do it while you're here, even. Or if you love it, I can finish it while you go watch Real Housewives, or while you're out, or whatever." Her razor-edged brow lifts again. "So this is penance?" "This is me following through on what I said I'd do," I say. "Late, obviously, and you're not obligated to forgive me because of it. It's not a trade. And I know an over-the-top gesture doesn't make up for being generally shitty. I would love it if you forgave me, but if you don't feel like you can, for whatever reason, I understand." Her tongue runs over her bottom teeth. Slowly, she saunters toward me, her green eyes sharp and lips pursed. She stops right in front of me, arms still crossed. Then, she grabs me, hugs me, uncomfortably tight, almost painful, ultimately perfect. "I'm sorry too," she says. "For what?" I cry, alarmed. "I may have overreacted," she says. "It's just sometimes I feel like the whole last decade was a wash for me, minus Mulder. Like I'm starting over from scratch, and so everything needs to be exactly right as soon as possible to make up for lost time. I just got so excited to have a new, real friendship, and I put too much pressure on it." I shake my head. "I hurt you. I did the exact thing we literally bonded over hating. I don't think you overreacted." She draws back. "You did do that, but I could have left you a voicemail or texted you or something when I realized it was happening. Instead," she sighs, "instead I waited to, like, bust you." Seemingly in a hard right turn, she says, "I told you I'd picked out a marriage counselor for me and Duke, even though he wouldn't agree to go to one." I nod. "Well, by the time our first appointment rolled around, we'd split, but it was too late to cancel without paying a fee, so I went. And I thought I was showing up to, like, complain about him, which I definitely did." "Of course," I say. "But I kept going. And I realized I had this tendency to set up tests, like, how long can I be in the room before he looks up from his phone? Or if I don't say anything, will he ever do the laundry?
Or, if I never suggest we get together with friends or do anything fun, will he be the one to make plans or does it all fall on me? Which made sense. I was tired of having the same conversations over and over again and never getting different results. So yes, you went into the love bubble slow fade with Miles, but let he among us who's never done that throw the first stone or whatever. My point is, you're not my ex-husband, and this wasn't your 420th strike. You blew me off. Big deal. It happens. What happened to when people tell you who they are, believe them? I say, still waiting for a trap door to open in the floor. All your actions told me, she says, is that you're human. Which is good, because I don't think I have it in me to be friends with someone who's perfect. No more than I have it in me to be friends with someone who says one thing and does another 10 times a month. I'm going to hurt you at some point, too. I don't want to, but it'll happen. I have a kid, I have a whole life, just like you. But I don't want to lose this friendship over one fight just because I'm scared it could happen again. You're becoming kind of important to me, Daphne. Kind of? I squeak out. Kind of really important, she amends. I only realize I'm crying when I see the alarm splash across Ashley's face. Hey! She grabs my arms, nails sinking into my biceps. It's okay, really. I don't want to be a person who does that to people, I say. Maybe that's what's wrong. Maybe that's why I can't. Daphne, chill for a second, she says, somehow stern, without being unkind. Tell me what's going on. I shake my head.
We're talking about us. I can deal with the other stuff later.
Honey! She tugs me over to sit at the foot of her velvet-upholstered bed. Friends talk about the other stuff. When I meet her gaze, her brow is grooved with concern. I feel an intense crush of love for her then, and fresh shame that I could ever forget this person's birthday, regret that I missed out on what honestly would have been an amazing Saturday night. After everything with Dad, I'd wanted so badly to escape myself, my life, that I forgot about all the beautiful little pieces of it I've been acquiring like sea glass these last few months. Things that no one can take from me. I sniff. It's really okay. I feel better just having everything out in the open between us. Hey, she says. Remember me, Ashley? I always want to talk about it, so back up. Is this or is it not about you shitting where you eat with regard to Miles?
There was no shitting involved, I say. I'm not that adventurous.
Holy shit! She cries at the nonverbal confirmation. She scoots forward, dropping her voice. It happened. How was it? Did he just stare lovingly into your eyes the whole time? He seems like a loving starer. My cheeks heat.
No, we didn't make unblinking eye contact for 40 minutes straight.
40 minutes? She shrieks. Not all at once, I hurry to add. It was more like a very intense 15 minutes, a cool-down period, and then a more well-paced 30 later. Okay, now this surprises me, she says. Trust me, I say. I'm well aware of how little sense he and I make. She scoffs. No, you two make perfect sense. I just would have imagined Miles would be so overeager that he'd sail straight through to the finish line with no decorum. There was decorum, I say. Hot, charming guys never learn how to work for it, she muses.
He worked for it.
Immediately, I want to take it back. I've never had this kind of friendship before, the sort you see women have in movies, where they spare each other none of the gory or lusty details, the best friend who teaches you how to put in a tampon at 13, or texts you from the bathroom the night she sleeps with someone for the first time. Sadie was the closest to that I ever got. But she'd grown up with brothers and always had more guy friends than girls. She was talkative and funny, but never open about things like this. And as close as I've gotten to Ashley, I'm also worried this is a betrayal. I don't know how Miles would feel about me sharing this. I have this somewhat ludicrous thought that I should have asked him when we last talked. Actually, it's not ludicrous. I can easily imagine the conversation, how not weird it would feel to ask, can I tell Ashley? Which only makes me feel more emotionally hungover and confused.
Every time I think of Miles, I think of what he said, and my heart starts racing, my whole body responding like I'm being hunted. No fight, pure flight.
I shouldn't be talking about this, I say.
Maybe, she says gently. You need to? I must look suspicious, because she adds, I swear I'm saying this as a friend, not the friendly neighborhood gossip monger.
I need to talk about it.
I relent.
Just not about it. I feel like that should have stayed private.
She pantomimes zipping her lips shut, but hasn't even finished when she chimes in. But for what it's worth, everything you've said has only made me love and respect him more.
Miles is great, I say. I just don't think Miles and I are great for each other.
Why? Ashley asks. You're unbelievably happy when you're around him. That's kind of the main thing that matters.
I'm exactly the kind of person he can't handle being with, and he's exactly the kind who could destroy me,
I explain. Honey, Ashley touches my hand.
That's how it works. That's love. I get too swept up in him, Ash, I say. I almost let myself get absorbed again, and for what? I know better.
You're being too hard on yourself, she says.
He ran, Ashley.
My voice breaks.
He was supposed to pick me up from work the next day, and he just never came.
Her mouth falls open as she takes in my meaning.
I didn't hear from him for hours, until I texted him.
Oh, God, Miles, no! She groans, like he's here to reason with.
And then Peter came by, I say.
Holy fuck, she yelps.
He and Petra broke up.
Another shocked gasp. No, she says, aghast. Miles didn't.
He says he was just helping her move her stuff out,
I say.
But Peter said they're on the path to rekindling.
What in Satan's ballsack? She demands. Then, thinking better of it, says, Look, Peter's bitter and Miles is a nice guy. Of course he helped her move out.
I know, I say.
He wouldn't tell me he loved me if he intended to get back together with Petra. Maybe it's naive, but I really believe that. Or maybe I just want to.
That's not the point, I say.
It's certainly a point, Ashley says, if not the point.
There's a job, I blurt. Near my mom. I think I have a real shot at getting it.
She assesses me for a long beat.
Shit. I wanted to tell you right away, but...
She looks down at her hands. I was icing you out. She sighs and squeezes my hands.
When you move, just don't forget about me, okay? Trust me, I couldn't,
I say tearily, and I mean it.
I could barely handle this week without you. I don't want to do that again.
Couldn't agree more. Her eyes drift up to the cut-in. What a disgusting color.
It truly, truly is, I say.
Her smile grows, eyes dropping to me. Want to put on the TV and keep going? Do you? I ask. I think it'll be fun to have an ugly room for a while, she says. Duke couldn't abide ugliness. Or dogs. She perks up. Maybe I should get a dog. She looks to me for feedback.
I think you should do exactly what you want to do,
I tell her. Let's rob a bank, she says.
I think you should get a dog.
34. Saturday, August 10th, 7 days. Later, in the kitchen, picking over a plate of pizza rolls, Ashley invites me to stay with her until the readathon. I haven't had a roommate other than Duke in a long time, she says, and this house is fucking huge. It'd be fun. Speaking of the size of your house, you've never mentioned... I trail off. That I live in a Bond villain lair? Ashley says, which gives me permission to more openly call a spade a spade.
That you're rich as fuck.
She snorts. I am not. Duke has cookie money. Cookie money? I repeat.
Like he knocked over a Girl Scouts truck and started a black market operation?
Like he's the heir to a cookie fortune, she says.
I didn't know cookies could have fortunes, I say. I mean, other than fortune cookies.
Oh, yeah.
She pops another pizza roll in her mouth.
Anything can have a fortune if you're greedy enough.
At the look on my face, she adds, I mean, obviously not Duke. He could have fought me for the house and he didn't. But I'm positive that if you go far enough back through his family tree, someone made a deal with the devil or, like, killed someone to get their hands on a secret recipe.
I look forward to their HBO drama, I say.
She's quiet for a moment. You should let Miles know you're staying here.
It's not like that with us, I remind her.
You don't want him charging into the FBI offices claiming you've been taken, do you? She asks.
Taken, I say. Like kidnapped?
I don't know, whatever happens in those movies you two are obsessed with, she says. Like held at gunpoint and forced to rob a museum with your highly specialized skill set or whatever.
Right, I'm going to be taken by someone who needs the inside scoop on children's literature.
Just let him know you're staying here, she says.
Fine, I groan.
Staying with Ash, I type out. He replies almost instantly, K.
There, I tell her.
Good. Ashley tips her head toward the back doors. Now let's watch something gory.
Real Housewives, I guess.
This, she says, must be what it's like to be a proud mother.
Did you forget about Mulder? I say.
Just for a second, she says. He's back now, though. On Monday night, while Miles is at work, I run back to the apartment to pack some clothes. Aside from our differences in personal style, Ashley's both shorter and curvier than I am, and even the slouchy jersey dress she lent me for work today managed to hang from my chest like two deflated balloons. Tuesday, on our way in, we hit up a drive-through coffee kiosk near her house. She's not a morning person, and we barely speak until we get to work, at which point her first real words of the day are, "Wow, maybe you should move in with me. I could be on time every day." "We're 4 minutes late," I point out. "Which is 4 minutes earlier than usual," she says. "If I moved in with you," I say, "I don't think our friendship would survive that."
"I'm not sure we would even survive that," she says.
"It'd be like some deranged 80s sitcom with a vaguely haunted laugh track."
"What's this about you moving in together?"
Harvey asks, emerging from his office, mug in hand.
"We're not," Ashley and I both say.
"Relieved to hear that," he says. "It's manageable for one of you to be late every day, so long as the other is early."
"And which of us is which?" Ashley asks, feigning ignorance. After work, we grab burritos, then pick up Mulder from after-school band practice.
"This is my friend Daphne," she tells him as he climbs into the back seat of her hatchback with a trombone case nearly as big as he is.
"Daphne, this is Mulder."
"Hi,"
I wave. I expect a sulky preteen non-response, but despite his overall aesthetic projecting this,